Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. It's my pleasure today to be joined by one of the fine political writers in the United States today to talk about his brand new book. Our guest will be David Sirota, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Uprising. But first, before we go to David Sirota, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. A new initiative was launched this week, bringing together public and private sector groups to raise public awareness about America's digital divide and to build the political and popular will to address the problem. The InternetForEveryone.org initiative is premised on the idea that access to a fast, open, and affordable internet is a basic right for all Americans. At a press conference held Tuesday in New York, Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver explained.
We're here today because we can no longer leave this critical issue in the hands of Congress or the phone and cable companies that have dominated the policymaking process for years.
The future of nearly all media, television, radio, phones, movie, and newspapers are all moving to a digital platform. Closing the digital divide, Silver says, must be a national priority. Robin Chase, a co-founder of Zipcar, agrees.
Internet access is required for full participation in society today. Maybe it's not as basic as water, but it's definitely as basic as hot water.
Columbia University law professor Tim Wu compared the economics of bandwidth to that of the oil industry.
Production is controlled by a tiny cartel that sets prices high and keeps them there.
Environmental and social justice activist Van Jones said that too many people are in grave danger of being left behind.
The right to vote is diminished when people don't have access to the blogosphere and all of the discussion and debate that goes on. The right to survive, we saw in the California wildfires. Those communities, those people who had access to good information at the drop of a hat could figure out if they were in danger and get out and survive. Those who didn't, mostly Latino farm workers, were burned alive. It's a matter of life and death. Also with the economy, we're working to build an inclusive green economy. But it's hard for people to find a job they don't know about. And so the opportunity to have equal access to the workforce increasingly depends on equal access to information. So both for our democracy, for our survival, for our economic opportunity, we need internet for everybody.
For more information, go to internetforeveryone.org.
Versus youth centers is only the surface of it.
I think community can make or break anybody.
Youth Rights Media is a nonprofit organization in New Haven, Connecticut that empowers youth to understand and challenge the power structures in their communities. They premiered their latest documentary, No Haven, last week at the Yale Art Gallery. No Haven is a call to prioritize funding for youth centers instead of youth jails for nonviolent crimes. With an energetic staff led by executive director and co-founder Laura McCarger, Youth Rights Media builds youth power and leadership by engaging young people in video media production and community organizing. Justine Case is an intern with Youth Rights Media. She calls it a home away from home and says the biggest lesson she's learned there is the importance of leadership.
Before I started coming to Youth Rights Media, you know, I was making some bad decisions in life. And when I started coming here, everybody's preaching to me leadership and whatnot. And then, eventually, I ended up listening to them, and people were telling me, try something else in life, you know? You don't always have to follow other people's decisions. It's okay to follow your own.
Kenny Brown comes to Youth Rights Media every day after school. He worked on the No Haven documentary and is working to get it out into the community.
We'll screen it at like a public place, at a library or like a theater. We just do it just to like open up the eyes to people that don't really understand what we're here for. Once we screen it, we'll put it on YouTube, on our YouTube account, or we'll sell like DVDs and stuff so they could have it for their own personal appliances and stuff so like they can see it for themselves or like show other people.
Youth Rights Media has had success in engaging and changing their community. Their film, Know Me, is used as part of a training workshop for the New Haven Police. Another film helped shut down a troubled juvenile detention center for boys that was cited for its violence and lack of programs for the residents.
When you have somebody telling you that you won't be nothing, you're not going to amount to nothing, you start to believe it.
For more information about Youth Rights Media, go to youthrightsmedia.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings, I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our guest today has been a frequent guest on the program. He's David Sirota, political writer and author. He's here today to talk to us about his brand new book, just published by Random House, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. David Sirota, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, you've been on the show before, most recently in January of this year, and you're one of our favorite commentators on politics. You were in the process of wrapping up this book, as I recall, last time you were on the air. For those listeners who didn't hear you before or haven't heard you talk about the book, explain why you decided to write the book and what your basic point is.
Well, I decided to write the book because in my organizing work and working on political campaigns through 2006, I got the sense, I think like everybody, that the country is really, really angry. And I wanted to look at who is trying to capitalize on this anger and on this backlash moment on both the right and left. And what I set out to do was report on people who are trying to organize this what I call an uprising, which I describe as the middle state between the typical disengaged chaos and those moments of social movements in our past history. Each social movement, I think, started with an uprising, and so I think we're in that uprising state. And what I found is that yes, the country is angry. Yes, we are in the midst of an uprising, but it's not clear which direction this uprising will ultimately take us. It could take us certainly in a progressive direction, but it could take us into a more conservative direction, like that last uprising of 1980, which was driven into the conservative movement.
What have been the progressive uprisings in American history? What do you see as the parallels, if things turn out in a way you would like, with this uprising?
Well, I think we saw at least three progressive uprisings in the last 100 or so years. We saw the one right in the very turn of the 20th century that became what was known as the Progressive Era, the original progressive movement, and the populist movement that cleaned up workplaces, the beginning of the labor movement, trust busting, women's suffrage. And then I think we saw another one in reaction to the Great Depression, that became the New Deal, labor law reform. And I think we saw one other in the mid-1960s with that 1964 election in the midst of the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War uprising that gave us, you know, ultimately an end to that Vietnam War, the Great Society programs, Medicare. And I think, of course, we've seen, again, that fourth uprising, I think, of the last 100 years, was a conservative uprising in and around 1980. And so I think we can move into, and the country is more likely to move into, an uprising period that is marked by getting the government back involved in the economy to make sure the economy works for ordinary people, as opposed to the more anti-government uprising that marked the 1980s.
David Sirota, in The Uprising, you write about this sort of populist moment as being one not just exclusively of the left, of liberals, of progressives, but also a ferment and turmoil on the right. And one of the things that, is, of course, is striking to me about American politics in the last few years has been, you know, almost the free fall disintegration of the Republican Party. I mean, it really has almost been out of the blue, hasn't it?
It has been, but I think what it is the waning of the conservative movement that originally started in the late 1970s uprising. That there was that uprising in the post-Watergate moment that could have been capitalized on by progressives, but it wasn't. And along came the conservatives to organize it into a full-fledged movement and using the Republican Party as a vehicle for that movement. And I think that now it's almost 30 years later. That movement is waning, and I think it's waning because I think that there is now a fairly clear direct line between conservative policies and the economic crises we're living through. I mean, there is a clear line between the deregulatory, quote-unquote, free trade agenda of Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, and the housing crisis, the outsourcing crisis, the wage crisis, and the credit crisis. And I think that that has basically, as you said, destroyed, that realization has destroyed the Republican Party.
And as you just made clear in your comment and through your career and your writings, you hardly exonerate the Democratic Party for its conduct over the past two decades.
No, you're right. And I don't because I think that while the Clinton era and certainly some members of Congress slowed the march of that conservative movement, it only slowed it and in many cases was complicit with it. Look, it was Bill Clinton who passed NAFTA, telecom deregulation, welfare reform, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which was designed to help prevent the kind of credit bubble crisis we're going through right now. So you know, there are really two parties in this country, and it's not the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. It's the Money Party, as I call it in the book, and the People Party. And right now the Money Party controls most of the Republican Party and somewhere about roughly half of the Democratic Party. And I think that that's changing. I think that the uprising is a backlash to the dominance of this Money Party. And I think it's an exciting moment.
Our guest today in Media Matters, David Sirota, author of the brand new book, just came out, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington, just published by Random House. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. This program was recorded shortly before going on air, so the bad news for our listeners is they can't call in and ask David Sirota a question themselves. They've got to sit back and listen to us. The good news is I get to talk to David Sirota for 53 minutes uninterrupted, and I get to hog the microphone, Ronald Reagan style. You know, one of the things that's also been interesting, I want you to talk about, if you would, I want to go later through a lot of the stuff in the book and talk about populists and progressives on the left and liberals and all that. But I do want to talk about the sort of conservative or right-wing populism and signs of it, because to me that's a really interesting phenomenon. And, you know, we see now Bob Barr running for president, former Republican member of the House, very prominent in the 1990s, is leading the campaign against Bill Clinton. And then Ron Paul running for president in the Republican primaries, but running on a primarily as an anti-war candidate with a position on the war in Iraq well to the left of any Democrat, with the exception of Dennis Kucinich. What are we supposed to make of this?
Well, I think this is a reaction again. I think that what populism really is an angry reaction to an establishment that is perceived as not only not paying attention to crises, but actually working to create crises. And so I think that the Ron Paul phenomenon and the Bob Barr phenomenon, this is one expression of that populist outrage. Now, I don't agree with Ron Paul or Bob Barr on a whole lot of issues, but I do think that the impulse for the Barr candidacy, for the Paul candidacy, and for many third-party candidacies on the right and the left at the presidential level is the impulse is a backlash, is a sense that, I guess on Paul and Barr's behalf, that the Republican Party is not doing what it should be doing to represent ordinary people. And I think, again, I think that the enthusiasm you saw for Ron Paul's candidacy is shows just how superheated this anger really is.
You know, in the book you talk about some, and you've written about widely before, some members of Congress who you've worked with or worked for or advocated their case. And I'd like to just talk briefly about them and what they mean for this moment we're in as galvanizing political figures. First, let's start with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Right. He is a major figure in the book. And I think that what I ask in the chapter that includes Sanders is can the uprising be effectively represented in an institution like the U.S. Senate by a clear uprising champion like Bernie Sanders? And, you know, the chapter is called The Permanent Barrier, and that's Alexander Hamilton's term that he used to describe the Senate when justifying it. He said they needed a permanent barrier to the popular will. Basically a barrier to uprisings like we're dealing with now.
I mean, our House of Lords.
Well, exactly, precisely. And what I found is that the progressives in Congress, like Sanders, have to figure out how to use the Senate's math to the uprising's advantage. That in many cases, the power of an institution like the Senate is to stop things. And so when you try to think about it in those terms, how do you use the power of stopping things for an uprising? Well, you get right down, the first thing I think about is the war. I think that a lot of progressives in Congress have yet to figure out how to use the power of stopping things to stop cutting checks to President Bush to prosecute the war. And I looked at how Sanders was struggling with that. In 2007, he had just gotten into the Senate, and it's a tough issue. I mean, you know, senators have to worry about getting things through, and so if they filibuster something, their other colleagues can punish them in other ways. So it's a very, very tough balancing act. And I think what comes through in the book is that to try to be effective for the uprising, whether in the Senate or in any other arena of politics, there is this balancing act between acting on the inside and acting on the outside, and it's very, very difficult to balance.
And then another figure I'd like you to talk about, if you would, David Sirota, is another person who's been a guest in this program, Sherrod Brown.
Sherrod Brown is a wonderful story in that he was elected in what is universally known as the most important presidential state on the electoral map, Ohio. And this he did this by being an unabashed progressive populist on economic issues. And people said, oh, you know, he's too liberal, he'll never win that state. And he won.
Well, if I can interrupt you, not just on economic issues, but really what distinguished him was also being progressive on the war, on gay rights,
right,
on the environment, on all the stuff they said Ohioans would never go for.
That's right, that's right. I mean, really an unabashed progressive on all of the major issues. And he was rewarded with a very resounding win, again in a state that has been the Republican stronghold, the Republican key to winning national elections forever. And you know what I looked at with him in the book is how he can represent or how he's trying to represent, as I said, the People Party's interests in a Senate that is so dominated by big money. I mean, Sherrod's signature issue is fighting against corporate written trade deals, and the Senate has been one of those institutions that passes those deals by wide margins. Usually, the fight has been, if there has been a fight over NAFTA-style trade deals, the fight has been in the House, which is more of a contentious place. In the Senate, because it's so dominated by money, those things have sailed through. And so what I've looked at is how he has been able to be effective in the Senate on behalf of those issues, and he has been effective. I mean, are at a point right now where a number of these NAFTA expansions, proposals for NAFTA expansions, have been stalled because of the leadership of people like Sherrod Brown.
And then, David, sort of one last politician you talk about in the book who also joined the U.S. Senate in the 2006 sweep, John Tester of your former home state of Montana.
John is really a unique member of the Senate in that he is I think the only one really to come straight out of basically a state legislature with nothing in between. When I lived in Montana, he was president of the Senate, of the state Senate, and then he ran for the U.S. Senate against a very tough primary. And I think the most interesting part of the chapter about him is that he recounts how when he got to Washington, a lot of the incumbent senators said, you know, we have to figure out how to crush primaries because they're supposedly weakening our party. And Tester stands up in this meeting right when he gets to D.C. and says, well, you know, I don't think that's the right thing to do. I mean, I think primaries are good for our party. And if there wasn't a primary, I wouldn't have been here. You guys, you know, he's talking to the Senate Democrats. You guys had tried to select another candidate in the primary. And so, you know, to me, primaries, the ability or the right of people to challenge incumbents for their own party's nomination is a key part of this uprising from Ned Lamont on down, the Senate candidate who defeated Joe Lieberman in the primary.
Whose campaign you were active on as well.
Right. I worked on his campaign. And so I think it's really good that there is somebody in that Senate basically speaking up for the more confrontational tactics of the uprising.
Now, the subject that comes up unavoidably, not only in your book, but any discussion of issues like populism and political uprising, is the role of the media, how the media, the mainstream media, but all media for that matter, cover it or don't cover it. And then how much the media, the news media, sort of serve as sort of police to border the boundaries of legitimate debate and to keep populist perspectives out of legitimate airing.
Well, we see this all the time. I mean, from every issue, from the Iraq War down to economic issues, there is a very narrow scope that the mainstream or corporate media allows to be represented in the debate. For years, being against the war was considered an unserious position. The serious position was considered basically swallowing hook, line, and sinker the Bush administration's blatant lies about why we went into Iraq. You look at the media debate around an issue like trade and globalization, and people, you know, the media will tell you, says that anybody who is for fair trade, who is for any kind of tariffs or protection, is some sort of Luddite. Of course, you know, this kind of spin is rooted in rhetoric and fiction. I mean, our country developed its economy in the 20th century into the powerhouse that it is precisely through strategic tariffs and protection and fair trade. But you don't get that from the media because the media, when it's not in a power-worshipping mode of celebrity political journalism that marked, I think, the Iraq War, it's in a corporate mode, a mode that doesn't question corporate power. You know, a lot of it has to do with an underlying idea that the media is not objective when it comes to corporate power because the corporate media is a corporation. And so I think that what this uprising is against is not just the political system and the politicians, but when I say the establishment, it includes the media. I think people really fundamentally sense that the national media is projecting a reality that's not reality. That's not the reality that people are dealing with. And so I think the backlash is in part also against the media.
Our guest today on Media Matters, David Sirota, author of the brand new book, the New York Times bestseller, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580. This program was recorded shortly before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let David Sirota and me do all the talking. The big political story, of course, of 2008, I think, right now at least, both in mainstream media and without, what people are talking about is a presidential race. And in particular, I think what's capturing the attention of everyone, is the Obama phenomenon, Barack Obama getting the nomination of the Democratic Party. How does this figure into your analysis, David?
Well, I think that Obama rode the energy of the uprising to the Democratic nomination. And I think his victory in that nomination fight was resounding, even though it was a mathematically close. I mean, he was running against an establishment candidate who had spent the last basically generation preparing this kind of run, building up a campaign and a political network. And this guy who was in a state legislature 4 or 5 years ago won the Democratic presidential nomination over her. So I think that's shows just how desperate for change people really are. And I think Obama offers a lot of potential. And I think he's done a good job of capturing this uprising moment through how he structured his campaign. Small donors, delegating responsibility to activists on the ground. I mean, I think that's wonderful. And I think that, again, offers a lot of potential. But it is just potential. And that's what I fear coming out of this race, is that people believe, I think, that voting for Obama or being involved in his campaign is supporting or being involved in a social movement. In other words, I think they think that this candidate is a social movement. And I think that really fundamentally misunderstands history. Candidates, political parties, and elections are not social movements. They are vehicles for social movements. And I think the media has contributed to this portrayal of candidates as change unto themselves, as candidates, as movements unto themselves, this obsessive, celebrity-driven, personality-driven media that now covers our campaigns in oftentimes an issue-free kind of way has led the public to believe that the only way to make a difference, that the only thing that really matters in public life is voting for a president. And it really is a disempowering message. It's a paternalistic portrayal that says presidents hand down change from the mountain. And as opposed to what history really has shown us, that presidents are forced to accept change, oftentimes when they don't want to, by real grassroots uprisings and social movements.
And David Schroeder, you were on in January, as I recall, my memory is a little foggy in my old age. You were touting the Edwards campaign, and Edwards is very populist economic policies, in fact, populist across the board policies. What happened to Edwards?
I think that what happened was that his message was in many ways co-opted, and I think that's a good thing. I don't think it was a good thing for John Edwards, but I think that his message was so compelling that you started to see all the candidates echoing his rhetoric on income inequality, trade, globalization, jobs, the unfairness of the economy, and I think that when they co-opted his message, they were running. In the other parts of their campaign, they were running probably better campaigns. And so he didn't win the nomination, but again, I think he had a huge impact, and in a good way.
How do you think Obama's going to do in November?
I think he'll do well, but there's an if. I think he'll do well if he finds his voice on economic issues. He has not found his voice on economic issues at all. He has, I think, tried to simultaneously appease Wall Street and portray himself as something of a populist. And I don't think that's going to work. And I hope he realizes the error of his ways in trying to have it both ways, because I hope he realizes that John McCain's biggest weakness is these economic issues. I mean, John McCain's running around championing NAFTA as something terrific. And I think that Obama needs to find his voice on those issues. And it's not encouraging, frankly, in these first few weeks of him being the general election nominee, that he's going to find his voice. I mean, his first announcement as a general election candidate on economic issues was that he was hiring as his top economic advisor, the top advisor to Bob Rubin, the CEO of Citigroup, the major Wall Street bank that has helped give us the credit and financial crisis we're now dealing with. So that's not a good sign.
David Sirota, I mean, we have yet at this time of this taping know who the vice president choice will be for Obama, nor will we probably know it until close to the convention. Do you think this will be an important choice, and do you have people you think would be especially good for sending the right message, for populist message?
I think it'll be a hugely important choice, and my hope is that Obama find somebody who does have those credentials on kitchen table economic issues. And I think there's a lot of them. I think there's, as we discussed, I think there's Sherrod Brown from a swing state, a great economic populist. I think Jim Webb from another swing state, he has voiced real strong economic themes, also has some national security credentials in being a big critic of the war, while also having served as Secretary of the Navy. I think Barack Obama can look for an unconventional kind of candidate, perhaps somebody from the labor movement. I mean, we used to, in this country, consider major labor leaders as potential vice presidential picks. I wrote a column a couple weeks ago suggesting Anna Berger.
I saw that.
The head of Change to Win, the Change to Win Federation, vice president of the Service Employees International Union. So I think there's a lot of people out there. And my hope is that he picks somebody who signals that he's serious about challenging power, as opposed to somebody that signals he's serious about appeasing the status quo.
Do you think that ultimately, if this uprising proves successful, the Democratic Party will be the vehicle, or do you think it's going to require a development of either a third party or a party that replaces the Democratic or Republican Party?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party, at least in the short term, has to be one of the main vehicles for this populist uprising in terms of passing legislation. Now, again, my book has a lot of stuff in there about direct action and successful efforts on direct action, which I distinguish from electoral action as, you know, the action where people take matters into their own hands, not really through elections at all. So shareholder democracy, shareholder activists filing shareholder resolutions, unions organizing, workplace, those are direct actions. But as it relates to electoral action, I think that the Democratic Party has to be one of the major vehicles. In the long term, I think third parties can be a force, but they require structural changes, and specifically structural changes that allow what's known as fusion voting.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into this in my book. There are 8 states that still allow fusion voting. One of them is New York, where you have a third party called the Working Families Party.
And you talk about that in the book at some length.
Yeah, and the Working Families Party has basically leveraged fusion voting to become a major force in one of the biggest states in the country.
Explain it, please. Thank you very much, David.
Fusion voting basically allows third parties to cross-endorse major party candidates on the ballot. So if I'm running for the Senate in a fusion state, I can, if I get the nomination, I can run as the Democratic candidate and as the Working Families Party candidate. And if there are 2 voters, and one votes for me on the Democratic Party line, and one votes for me on the Working Families Party line, I get 2 votes. The votes are fused together. And what that's allowed to happen is that with a party like the Working Families Party, which is organized very narrowly around a narrow set of economic issues, it has allowed them to leverage power for those economic issues. And here's how. If I'm in the Senate and I got 15% of my vote or 10% of my vote on the Working Families Party line, and a bill to raise the minimum wage comes down the pike, I have to basically consider whether to vote for that bill or not and think about, if I vote against it, I'll probably not get that 10% of my vote next time because I won't get the endorsement of that party on the ballot. In other words, that party can withhold its nomination and therefore strip away votes that are often decisive. And that has leveraged a huge amount of power, and I think it can leverage a huge amount of power in other states.
Our guest, David Sirota, author of the brand new book, The Uprising, an Unauthorized Tour of the Populist Revolt Scaring Wall Street in Washington. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters, again, a tape show here in WILL AM 580, recorded shortly before going on air, so please don't call and sit back, relax, enjoy the program. David Sirota, how important is the Netroots, the Internet, the blogosphere to fueling and guiding, to some extent, this uprising?
I think the Netroots is not an uprising unto itself, and I think some of the Netroots bill the Netroots as an uprising unto itself, and I think that's inaccurate. I think the Netroots and the blogosphere and the Internet can be, what I say in the book, is the underground newspaper of the uprising, the connective tissue of this uprising. that calling the Netroots or the Internet its own movement is like calling telephone users its own movement. I mean, the Internet is a medium. But I think it's a medium that offers a huge amount of potential. And frankly, I don't think that potential is being used right now in the general sense. What I think is that we've got a lot of organizations and people using the Internet in a top-down kind of way, a broadcast model. So you have an organization that blasts out email blasts, and the flow of information goes either down to members or from members up to the central headquarters. I think that for the Internet to really, really coalesce this uprising around something positive is to meld that social networking technology of the Facebooks and the MySpaces to help people self-organize. So, for instance, you have Democracy for America. It has a DFA link program that is very, very unique in that if I'm a DFA member and you're a DFA member, I can communicate directly to you and not only to the central office of DFA. And I think that, if that starts becoming a bigger part of the intersection between the Internet and politics, I think that will really, really fuel this uprising.
Our guest, David Sirota. And David, I wanted to ask you if I can. You've had an interesting interview with Lou Dobbs regarding your book not too long ago on the Lou Dobbs radio show. And it seems to me that, you know, in terms of the uprising, you have immigration as an issue that is both is galvanizing different wings of people rising up, and maybe not, maybe often in very different directions. How does immigration play out in the uprising?
Well, it cross cuts the issue of, immigration is an issue of trade and globalization ultimately, and I think that what Lou Dobbs has done, and the Minutemen, who I visited as well, I think what they do is that they treat immigration as the problem, and illegal immigration is the problem. And I think illegal immigration is the symptom of a bigger problem. The problem is that there's an impoverished country on our southern border, a country that we have helped impoverish through our trade and globalization policies, NAFTA, subsidized agribusiness, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that what Lou Dobbs and the Minutemen do is that they focus on the symptom, because the symptom is easier to demagogue for the right part, the conservative part of the uprising. And I think that's a shame, because I think what they're doing is they're defining the us versus them as us Americans and them as Mexicans, when in fact the real us versus them is us Mexican and American workers and them, the tiny minority of Mexican and American business elites who have created a international economic policy that creates this wage cutting, environment destroying competition, and which creates this undocumented this flow of undocumented workers that helps undermine wages. So I think it's really I see where the right's political utility is in trying to demagogue this issue in the way that they're demagoguing it, but I also think that it's missing the real point and could be channeled into such a much more productive way.
You know, the original populist movement going back 125 years from now to the late 19th century was largely a movement of rural, poor white people, farmers, for the most part. And racism played a role, white racism played a role in it. It's always been sort of the a difficult issue in American politics, whatever the politics were. Do you think this country is changing dramatically or a little bit or in terms of racial dynamics? What's your take, and how does it fit into the uprising?
I think that racism in an overt way, I think, is a generational thing, that you see it more pronounced, at least in voting trends and things that we can measure, among people who are older. And so I think that means that it's ultimately going to lessen. I don't think it'll ever go away, or at least not in my lifetime. I think that what's so interesting about this uprising today is that on the issue of race, this really could go hardcore in one direction or the other. That is to say that if this uprising goes in a progressive direction, I think it will be a class-unifying progressive direction, that class, economic class, will define the policies that come out of this uprising if it goes in a progressive direction. If it doesn't go in a progressive direction and it goes in a conservative direction, I think it will actually be driven specifically into a racial agenda. More xenophobia, more immigrant bashing, and immigrant bashing is underneath it. It has a race component to it. More of the welfare queen rhetoric, and even the militarism that would come out of a conservative uprising, I think, has its roots in racial fears or fears of foreigners, xenophobia. So I think as this uprising relates to race, it's going to be the effects on the racial debate in this country will be particularly acute.
You just mentioned at the beginning of that last answer how racial voting, at least voting patterns, tend to skew along age lines. We've seen that in the Democratic primaries so far, where Hillary Clinton was doing really well, especially well among voters as they got older and older. And Obama did especially well among voters as they were younger and younger, when everything else was the same except for age. In your book and in your research for The Uprising, were you seeing generational splits there too?
I did. And where I saw it most was, I think, as it relates to the use of technology. The one thing that the internet and the net roots is it trends a little bit younger. Not 100% younger, but it trends a little bit younger. And what I found is that I think what's exciting about the internet in potentially being that connective tissue is that as young people move into these other uprisings, whether it's union organizing, whether it's organizing for community organizing, whether it's organizing for pressure on state legislatures, I think that will help push the best parts of the internet into those organizing efforts.
Our guest today, David Sirota, author of the brand new book, The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This show is recorded shortly before going on air, so please sit back, relax, let us do the talking. David Sirota, one of the major factors in the last generation of neoliberalism, of what's called conservatism, has been the role of evangelical religion, if nothing else, in providing a voting base to get politicians elected. How is religion playing a role in the uprising, and what's happened to the evangelical base for conservatism?
Well, two things on that. First and foremost, I think that, and I talk about this in the book, which is that Mike Huckabee's candidacy in the Republican primary showed that there could be a potential realignment here. Here was a guy who campaigned on the social conservative themes of the evangelical religious right, but also on thematically on progressive populist economic issues. I mean, this is a guy railing on CEO pay and unfair trade deals, and he won a number of primaries in some of the most conservative states in the country. So I think that signals the potential for a shift, a potential for a realignment on class-based economic issues, a realignment that potentially splits apart part of that Republican religious base from the corporate Republican Party. I also think that there's a resurgence of progressive religious politics, and I say that because of my work reporting on religious shareholder activists at the ExxonMobil shareholder meeting. You've got a number of religious institutions that are using their endowments and their funds to try to push very, very progressive shareholder resolutions. And I think that we tend to think of religious politics as dominated only by the religious right, but what I say in the book is that our country has a rich history of religious institutions taking up some of the most progressive economic causes there have been. And I think that as the economic crises of the day worsen, I think that kind of religious politics could reemerge.
It also seems, David Sirota, that what we're seeing an acceptance of an understanding that we are in a deep and profound environmental ecological crisis in the United States and the world, and that the traditional neoliberal market oriented sort of let's see who can make the most money and that'll sort everything out approach is not working across the board. Is that part of the uprising and some sort of ecological awareness?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think environmental politics in general are really fueling this uprising in a number of different ways. I think, as you talked about, the global climate crisis, I think, is moving religious activists in a new direction. I think that out in the Mountain West, for instance, that the conflict between the desire to drill for energy and to intensify extractive industries' effects on public lands has spurred a backlash among the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, the rank-and-file libertarians out in places like the West, people who don't want our public places and our landscapes destroyed by this unquenchable thirst for fossil fuels. And there really is a serious backlash to that. So when at the beginning of this, when you asked about the fracturing of the Republican Party because of this uprising pressure, you know, that pressure is coming in a number of different directions. And I think that you're right, that the environment is one of those multifaceted issues that is creating that pressure in all different kinds of ways.
David Shorter, what would a progressive, or assuming the uprising we're talking about does turn in a progressive direction, crystallize into the sort of movement that we think of when we think of the Great Society or the New Deal or the Progressive Era, or maybe something even better, but really become a concrete program for reform, what would be the core elements of this? What, something concrete my listeners can sink their teeth into?
I think you will see, if it goes in the right direction, I think you will see a re-regulation in all sorts of ways of Wall Street. I think you would see a new trade model that included strong labor and environmental protections, that gave ordinary citizens the same powers as corporations under our trade deals. You know, right now a corporation can sue a state and local government if a state and local government passes a public interest law, like a clean water law, that the company can claim cuts into its profits. Yet a labor union cannot sue in that same court for enforcement of labor laws. So I think you potentially see a whole new trade model. I think you could see a universal health care system. This is one of the oldest and longest fights now of the progressive for progressives, and I think now the time is right. I think you could see a windfall profits tax and other punitive measures on energy profiteers. So I think that is the outline of an agenda that you might see. And, of course, I should have mentioned that, you know, you could see an end to the war in Iraq, a not rhetoric about how bad the war is, but actual action to end it.
And who are the thinkers, present company excluded, who are the thinkers and writers that you look to sort of understand these issues that you would recommend people listening to the show who want to sort of learn more about the key issues facing us and some of the alternatives for the future? Who would you suggest they look to?
I think on an issue like trade and globalization, you can go and check out anything from the Economic Policy Institute, a great think tank in Washington, one of the few that actually has a progressive outlook on these issues. You can read the book Bad Samaritans by Heijun Chang, the economist from Cambridge, a new book out. It's a great book. I think on healthcare issues, you can look to the Campaign for America's Future, which is pushing a number of different proposals at the federal level. You can look to the Progressive States Network, which I'm on the board of, which pushes progressive legislation in our state legislatures. I think there's plenty of good ideas out there. I don't think our side is suffering from a lack of ideas. I think it's suffering, if it is suffering at all, I think it's suffering from a lack of cohesion. And I should have mentioned, of course, you know, Free Press, the organization that you started on reforming rules that deal with the media itself. I think that's a hugely important issue and a hugely important organization. But what I would say is I think that the obstacle is for all of us on the progressive side of the ledger is to try to unify around the issues that unify the country. I mean, right now, the Democratic Party, I think its orthodoxies are on issues that tend to culturally divide the country. Issues like choice. That's just an example. And I'm completely pro-choice, and I think it's good that the Democratic Party is pro-choice. The problem is that if the only issues that your orthodoxies are the ones that do culturally divide parts of the country, as opposed to also having orthodoxies on issues that unify the country, again, like opposing NAFTA, like getting us out of Iraq. If your orthodoxies are only on the issues that divide us, that hurts your chances to really form a coalition to win on all the issues.
And then I would like you to talk, if you would, David Schroeder, a little bit more about the Progressive States Network, which is an organization you started with Joel Barkin a few years ago, and I had the privilege for a while of being on the board and winning the honor of being the worst board member in the history of any organization ever. But this was a group, and I'll let you explain it, but just for our listeners' sake, this is a group that was set up specifically to be active at the state level in politics, at state legislatures, an area which I think you successfully demonstrated had really been laying fallow for the most part.
Exactly. I think that the conservatives, as part of their uprising, realized that there's a huge amount of power to be wielded at the state level. The conservative uprising, in fact, that started in the 70s, really in many ways started at the state level. I mean, Phyllis Schlafly, the conservative activist, Paul Weyrich, these leaders of the early conservative uprising, started their efforts through ballot initiatives and constitutional amendment drives at the state legislatures, legislative level, understanding that that level just wields a huge amount of power that people don't pay attention to. And I think that progressives have forgotten how much power can be wielded at the state level. I think that in our focusing on the presidential politics, congressional politics, we've forgotten just how much power exists at the state level, and the right hasn't. The right invested in an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can bet that any piece of right-wing economic legislation that moves through your state legislature has Alex's fingerprints all over it. And so what we tried to do a couple of years back, and we've done it successfully, I think, is start an organization that focuses resources on state legislatures to help pass progressive legislation. And there's been an enormous amount of success. And what I would encourage people to do is not pay attention to the presidential race, but devote some of your attention and your activism on your state legislature. I mean, your state legislature has a huge amount of power, and if you don't get involved in making sure that power is used for the right thing, somebody else will.
David Schroeder, almost all the projections for the 2008 elections for Congress in both the House and Senate suggest the Democrats would do well, and in the Senate they may even pick up as many as 5, 6, 7, 8 new seats, giving them a commanding majority. How does it look for the state legislature races going on around the country?
It looks pretty good, and I think that it's, you know, it's hard to give you an exact number, but what I can say is this. Right now, about one-third of all Americans live in a state where the governor and the two houses of the state legislature are controlled by Democrats. That power really has not been effectively maximized at all. So again, 1 in 3 Americans live in a completely democratically controlled state. And so if you think about how much power that would be to pass a progressive agenda, if you had 1 in 3 Americans who were living in states that had really championed a populist progressive agenda, and that those 1 in 3 Americans had seen just how different and how positive that progressive agenda would be as it passed into law, I think you see the potential of how our states can really be the place where major, major change begins.
David Schroeder, I want to ask you how the response to your book's been so far. I know it's just been out a month. You've been working hard to go out and speak about it. What is your sense of how people are responding, and how are the critics and the mainstream media responding?
Oh, boy. You know, the response has been, I think, somewhat surprised. I think people have expected me to be a partisan, and I think they've read the book and seen that I'm objectively describing what's going on the right and left. I mean, I acknowledge my own personal point of view, but the facts are the facts, and I think that that I've been surprised that a lot of the mainstream media's reviews has been quite positive. I mean, I couldn't believe it. A couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post gave it a positive review, and then just another couple of weeks ago, the Rocky Mountain News, the biggest paper in the Rocky Mountain region, and a conservative-leaning paper, said it was the perfect book for rebels of all persuasions. So, I'm thrilled. I mean, I'm a little nervous. I can't lie. When the establishment media says good things about you, it raises questions if I did something wrong. But I'll take it as it is.
Yeah, what's next, David Sirota, for you? Where do you go from here?
Oh boy, that's another great question. I don't really know. I think that one thing that's very tough to deal with right now is that I think the state of the media is very, very much in flux. I think the state of the progressive movement, which I consider myself a part of, has been underwhelming in supporting progressive media in general. A lot of the progressive movement's resources go into pure election activities. The right, it's a very different model from the right, which drove so much of its resources into media, into think tanks, into ideas, if you will. And so you know, for folks who want to get involved, folks who are in, who write, it's an uphill climb all the way, and I just have to figure out how to keep making a living at it.
Do you have another book in mind, or is that you're too busy on this one to think that far down the road?
Yeah, you know, I'm too busy, I think, right now to think about that. And if I said I had another book coming down the pike, I think my wife would would disown me.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, right. But you know, I've had some opportunities to write for the New York Times Magazine. I've talked to some other magazines. So I think I'll be around writing more.
Beyond yourself, would you say basically you're optimistic about this moment we're in historically? I mean, compared to where we were a decade ago, or do you see the gray clouds every bit as much?
I'm more optimistic than I was, and I'm always an eternal optimist. But I guess I'll put it this way. They say there's a silver lining. I think that there's a big, bright sun, but there's clouds around that sun. It's the opposite. I think that the clouds are that people are fooled, and I should say fooled again, into thinking that a candidate automatically means change. I mean, do we have to remember once again that Bill Clinton promised not to sign NAFTA until Mexico raised its wage and environmental standards, and then he signed, pushed NAFTA through Congress 16 months after making that pledge. What I worry is that people have forgotten that, have forgotten the concept that candidates are vehicles. And if that is the legacy of this book, and I'm trying to ram it home every time I talk about this book, if the legacy of this book is to remind as many people as possible that the work after Election Day, that on Election Day the work begins, the work doesn't end, if that's the legacy of this book, then I'll be proud to have written it.
On that note, David Sirota, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. Good luck with everything. My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle. See you all in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms. That's in today's forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area. This is WILL Urbana.